From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Bluegrass music is often misunderstood, but those who love it claim the rhythms work their way into your bones. Organizers at the Charm City Bluegrass Festival talk about the magic that keeps thousands of fans returning each year. Then historian Tim Newby tells us about Baltimore's deep connection to the genre and where it's headed.
We have this long history here, and we have traditional musicians, and you know, we've been evolving over time, and now we're getting to see the next kind of evolution of it and where it's going to go from here. And I think that's the great thing about any kind of music, but especially bluegrass, is it's constantly living and constantly evolving.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Bluegrass music is often described as an amalgam of Appalachian mountain music, folk music, country music, and even jazz. It turns out that Baltimore's music scene played prominently in the birth of bluegrass. Later in the show, we'll hear from an author and historian about Baltimore's bluegrass roots. With us now to talk about his dedication to deepening the connection is Phil Chorney, CEO and founder of the Charm City Bluegrass Festival and Baltimore Management Agency. The festival is coming up on April 27th. And 28th. Welcome to On the Record.
Oh, thanks, Sheila.
Also with us is Adam Keir, the festival's chief marketing officer. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you so much.
Phil, what is the backstory? How did you decide to produce the Charm City Bluegrass Festival?
It started as a hangout on my front porch in Hamden. A gentleman named Jordan August, who was my co-founder, he's a really good musician. I'm not a good musician by any stretch of the imagination. I can play like two chords on mandolin and maybe like one chord on guitar. And so, but it doesn't, that's the thing about bluegrass, is that lack of training or lack of skill doesn't stop you from being involved in the community of bluegrass. So Jordan would come over on a Wednesday night. We'd grab some beer from the wine market, sit on the front porch and pick. And people just started showing up, friends, strangers. They would bring instruments, they'd bring beer, they'd bring whiskey. And it turned into kind of like a bluegrass party, you know, every other week or so. And Jordan and I were both in the music industry from a management perspective, and we turned to each other and said, you know, we know the concert industry. I've been producing festivals for a couple of years, and you've been producing shows, and you're a musician. Let's throw a bluegrass party. Well, when you're looking at the logistics of throwing a wide-scale concert or party, it's not far off from a festival. So it kind of grew out of that idea, grew out of our love for live music and our love for production and our love for the music.
And so the first festival, as opposed to a picking session on your front porch. The first festival was?
6 years ago at Union Craft Brewing in their parking lot. It was, they just opened up, and we had some mutual friends that worked for Union, and we said, you know, we knew they were music fans, and we came to them with the idea, and they were all on board, right? I mean, there was no hesitation. They're like, yep, what do we need to do to make it happen? And that was that first year.
Adam, when did you become interested in bluegrass?
So my mom actually owns a violin company, International Violin. And from an early age, I used to go to really local bluegrass festivals in Arcadia, Maryland, with some of her employees. So a very young age, probably early teens. And then she was sponsoring a bluegrass band, the Byron Berline Band. And I got into bluegrass through her initially, and then even more so when I met Phil in a corporate marketing job that we both had together.
The festival takes place in Druid Hill Park. How did you decide on that venue?
You know, we'd outgrown our space at Union that first year. We had sold out, I think, a month prior to the festival. And so, you know, we knew that it wasn't sustainable to keep it there, but, you know, we knew Union was a great partner. And so we kind of searched around a little bit after that first year, and we were connected to Councilman Nick Mosby at the time, who was the councilman for the 7th District, and really formed a partnership between him, Parks and Rec, City of Baltimore, and us. And so Nick was instrumental in helping us move the festival to this beautiful beautiful space. And the, and even before we get there, we had to find that space. So Jordan and I at the time packed into his beat up SUV and drove around the city of Baltimore. And we said, you know, this needs to stay in the city. This is where the history of the music comes from. This is why we do it. We started this in Hamden. It needs to be in this general area. And so we were driving by and we got out of the car at right past the zoo, right on Arcantrolley Terrace over in the park. And you look out and there's these columns and you look down and it's a sweeping, almost like surreal amphitheater setting because you're so high up. And then there's a road and we looked at each other and we said, man, we got a production road. We have an entrance. We have an amphitheater. We have open space and it's right next to the conservatory. And so we walked a little bit further over and that upper section of the conservatory used to be a set of tennis courts. And the really interesting thing about that is that's the first place there was an integrated tennis match in the United States, I believe. And there's a big plaque there. We turned to each other and said, man, this speaks to us. This needs to be the spot where we have this festival. We're bringing something that a lot of folks in the city of Baltimore didn't know was, you know, part of their culture and their heritage. And this has to celebrate that diversity and that inclusion and what music's all about. So I met with Nick, and it was full steam ahead from that point, and just figuring out the logistics, working with within the city's, you know, parameters, and working with Parks and Rec, and that's how it ended up, and that's where it's been ever since. They're great partners, and that makes it worthwhile.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Phil Chorney, CEO and co-founder of the Charm City Bluegrass Festival, and Adam Keir, its chief marketing officer. We're talking about the festival that happens in just a couple weeks on Friday and Saturday, April 27th and 28th in Druid Hill Park. What are some of the highlights of the festival lineup?
Obviously, The Devil Makes Three, who are a band that combines arguably a little bit of punk rock with bluegrass music, folk style, some indie. And then you have the Steel Drivers, who are a band that was headed up by Chris Stapleton, a big country music star now, and they're a great bluegrass band. On Friday, the Traveling McCurries, the sons of the great Del McCurry and the adopted sons of Del McCurry, are performing as our headliner.
This Friday is the historic lineup, right?
It hasn't gone public yet, but it will be by the time that this airs. So I'll say that we've reached out to Del's team and said, you know, Del used to play with a lot of these great musicians here in Baltimore, the guys that really, in Tim's book, he highlights. You know, wouldn't it be great to get them on stage with Del's sons, Robbie and Ronnie, and have them play some tunes that you would have seen in a bar in Baltimore in the late 60s, early 70s? And so working with our team, we reached out and got these guys all together, and they all agreed to come on Friday and pick a set old style around a solo mic. I mean, it's going to be how it was. And these are some of those up-and-coming stars, the people that made bluegrass in Baltimore what it is today, the reason why we have bluegrass, the reason why we have Charm City Bluegrass Festival in Baltimore.
There, as you know better than I, a recent documentary called Charm City Bluegrass Festival, A Renewed Baltimore Tradition, directed by Mark Shapiro. And in it, we hear a musician who says, I'm under the impression that everyone loves bluegrass, but they just don't know it yet.
There couldn't be a truer statement. I think one of the fun things is Adam and I will both bring people to the festival every year who have never heard a lick of bluegrass music, and they come and they experience bluegrass. They experience the community. They experience the people from all walks of life hearing this organic, natural, you know, type of style of music, something that's deep in soul and tradition and pain and struggle. And I think everyone can relate to that. So once they hear the banjo notes or the fiddle runs or the guitar licks, they instantly become connected with it. And because everyone around them is so connected with the same music, it's almost like groupthink in a way. And they leave saying, you know, I like that bluegrass music. I think that's for me. And it's always fun to see those people and connect with them after the festival. And I think we've both had that experience, right, Adam?
Yeah, absolutely. It's music you can dance to for the most part as well. It's a true American art form through and through, obviously with influences from, you know, folk music from all over the world. But bluegrass is through and through American, and it's a music that does yield community. And it is music that, you know, for whatever reason, when you hear it, you just start dancing and people are really drawn to it that have never heard it before.
You also talked about diversity.
Yeah.
which I think means primarily age diversity. Looking at the documentary, this does not seem like a racially diverse
It's not, unfortunately. And that's one of the things that we're trying to buck that trend. So we're working with the Arkansas Terrorist Association to give a number of tickets to the citizens in that particular district. That way they can come and experience bluegrass music, which they may not have ever thought about. In years past, we partnered with like Orchids, with the BSO. I mean, it's something within the genre of music itself that it struggles with on a pretty common basis. I mean, it's a hot topic at IBMA, which is the International Bluegrass Music Association conference we've both been to. I mean, it was the keynote from Rihanna Giddens, who is an African-American opera singer, bluegrass banjoist. She's actually playing here in Baltimore in a couple of weeks, and she gave the keynote address, and that was the heart of her entire address, is finding ways to be more diversively inclusive while, you know, the music itself comes from rural areas. But what they don't know is that a lot of the gospel tunes and a lot of the traditional folk songs actually come from African-American roots, especially rural Appalachia-American roots. So, you know, it's something that we struggle with, and we obviously, our festival, anyone's welcome. We want everyone and anyone to come because, like we said earlier, once you experience bluegrass music, you're hooked.
Do you host other events throughout the year?
Yeah, we do. We host a series at Westminster Hall, which is in Baltimore City as well. And we also host events at places like the 8x10 and co-sponsor with venues like Soundstage and
All Good Presents.
Sometimes, yeah, with All Good Presents, who host events at 930 Club all over D.C., all over Baltimore. So we're pretty busy year-round and looking to ramp that up.
So if we link on our website to your website, people can learn about those events
absolutely.
Also.
Yep, and through our Facebook page as well.
And getting back to this festival coming up in a few weeks on April 27th and 28th, you mentioned the first year in the brewery parking lot, you sold out a month ahead of time. Are you sold out for this venue?
Our VIP tickets are sold out. And
how many people took part last year?
Man, we a rough count's around 4,000. So this year we're expecting closer to 4,500 to 5,000 is the number where we feel comfortable, and that's where we, you know, where it'll cut off. So if we hit that number, that would be a sight to see.
Well, I appreciate your telling us about it. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Phil Chorney is CEO and founder of the Charm City Bluegrass Festival and Baltimore Management Agency. Adam Keir is the festival's chief marketing officer. The Charm City Bluegrass Festival takes place on Friday and Saturday, April 27th and 28th in Druid Hill Park. We have a link to more information at the On the Record page, WYPR.org. We need to take a short break here on the record. Then we'll hear from an historian about Baltimore's bluegrass roots and Charm City's connection to the banjo. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Drinking dog whiskey, telling white lies.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about bluegrass music and its connection to Baltimore. We spoke earlier with organizers of the Charm City Bluegrass Festival that's happening April 27th and 28th in Druid Hill Park. With us now is Tim Newby, author of the book Bluegrass in Baltimore, The Hard-Driving Sound and Its Legacy. Newby teaches technology education at Chesapeake High School in Anne Arundel County, and he was featured in the documentary Charm City Bluegrass Festival, A Renewed Baltimore Tradition, directed by Mark Shapiro. Welcome to On the Record, Tim.
Thank you. Excited to be here and talk about some bluegrass and talk about Baltimore.
Well, first, is there typical instrumentation for a bluegrass band?
Well, generally when you think of it, you're thinking of acoustic instruments, and kind of the traditional lineup would be a mandolin, a fiddle, an upright bass, and a guitar. And then obviously a banjo. You need a banjo in there as well. And you can kind of have different variations of that, but that's kind of what you think of, you know, the traditional lineup and the lineup that Bill Monroe started when he kind of sort of evolved this sound back in the 40s.
Let's listen to a clip of Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys. On this one, they're performing A Voice from On High.
I hear a voice calling.
What is the story of Monroe and the birth of bluegrass?
Bluegrass, despite some of the kind of perceptions, is actually a fairly new word in the grand scheme of things. It wasn't really commonly used until the late 50s, early 60s. It comes from Bill Monroe, and he had a band, Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys, and it was named because he was from Kentucky. But originally, he was playing mostly kind of a country style. It was a little faster. It was played with this kind of instrumentation. But they were taking different variations of gospel songs and stuff like that. Eventually, they kind of started evolving it into what we think of as a traditional bluegrass sound, but it wasn't called that. It takes on the bluegrass sound because there was an acrimonious split between Bill Monroe and a couple guys in his bands, Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs. And when Flatt and Scruggs would go and play, people would want to hear the songs that they did with Bill Monroe, and they were kind of scared to say Bill Monroe's name around those two. And they would say, could you play some of those bluegrass tunes? And it sort of developed from there. And then in the 60s, Bill Monroe gave an interview, and he kind of said, I don't play country, I play bluegrass. And that was kind of when it was, now we have something different. But it took a long time for it to kind of develop into what we think of as bluegrass. And over the years, you know, it kind of became rooted in this idea that it was from Appalachia, but that's not necessarily entirely true. It has its roots there. Lots of the fiddle sounds comes from like old Irish jig kind of music. But it doesn't necessarily have its roots there. It really starts developing when people start leaving the mountains a little bit and start playing it. And I always say, like, lots of the songs, you know, sing about things like the old home place. Well, you can't miss the old home place till you leave it. So a lot of these people moved out of the mountains and moved into cities like Baltimore and Cincinnati and Columbus and Dayton. And they started playing this music, and it sort of evolved from there in the 50s into what we think of as bluegrass. And Bill Monroe was always kind of present throughout playing this and kind of leading the way a little bit.
How did the music's development get so connected to Baltimore?
Well, Baltimore at the time was, you know, one of the 10 largest cities in the U.S. in the 50s, which I think is something interesting to always think about. We don't think of Baltimore as being that big a city, but it was. And it was a huge hub of industry. We had Bethlehem Steel. We had the Martin Bomber factory. So you had a lot of these kind of Appalachian migrants moving out from West Virginia and Southern Virginia and Kentucky and places like that looking for work. And Baltimore was a prime destination. I mean, again, along with places like Columbus and Dayton. But they kind of came here, and what do people do? They bring things they know. So they brought some music, and how do people connect? Well, they get together, and they play music, and they pick, and they kind of do that. So they would get together and kind of pick and play, and eventually they were like, we can maybe take it out a little bit. We'll play in some of these local bars for kind of our friends or play out and stuff like that. I mean, as anybody does who gets in a band. So it sort of started slowly from there with people bringing the music. Baltimore was a little different than other cities, as we also had like Johns Hopkins and Towson College at the time. So you had this kind of folky side as well. And they kind of came together here more so than other cities. In other cities, they might be really separate, these folkies and these kind of true blue kind of hillbillies from the mountains. But they kind of came together here and played together. And we also had Mike Seeger here. Mike is Pete Seeger's half-brother, and he was living in Baltimore in the 50s. He was a conscientious objector to the Korean War and was doing his alternative service at a hospital around here. And he was a big music collector, obviously, coming from the Seeger family. And he met Arnold Dickens, who is brother to Hazel Dickens, who becomes a legendary kind of figure in bluegrass. And he kind of got involved in that scene. And one of the reasons Baltimore, more so than other cities, kind of evolved is he was here and he was recording music. And this is in the 50s, so people weren't whipping out their iPhones and recording it there. He had to lug around a gigantic recorder, and he had access to that. And he was making some albums here, and he used his buddies from Baltimore who he met at a house party. So these names kind of got out a little bit. And, you know, he was able to help kind of foster that connection. And he helps foster a connection with Alan Lomax, who's going to invite some Baltimore bands up to New York to, you know, take part in a concert up at Carnegie Hall. So it really was all of those elements coming together that made Baltimore kind of explode as far as a bluegrass scene.
That's Tim Newby, author of the book Bluegrass in Baltimore, The Hard Driving Sound and Its Legacy. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about Baltimore's deep roots of bluegrass music. Here's a clip from a Baltimore-based band from the 50s, Earl Taylor and the Stony Mountain Boys, performing White House Blues.
I can't find the code, you're bound to die, bound to die.
Is that the hard driving sound your book title suggests?
It is, and I love that song. Earl Taylor was a key figure in Baltimore, and they kind of played that sped up version. White House Blues is an old song that's been around since the 20s. It's actually about the assassination of President McKinley. So it's been around for a long time. A guy, Charlie Poole, used to do it, and it was not played like this. But Earl Taylor, along with his band, which included a banjo player named Walt Hensley, kind of took it and revved it up. And when I was kind of doing my research for my book, the term hard driving kept coming up. And what everybody told me is, you know, they played the music a little louder, a little faster here. And the reason why is they were mostly playing it in bars. And they were playing unamplified music in a bar. So, you know, if you're playing an acoustic instrument, think about the music, the sounds that are in a bar. You got people talking, people drinking. They're more interested in doing their thing. So they were playing louder, faster to draw that attention in to kind of overcome the rumble of what was being said in the bar and stuff like that. So it developed a little louder, faster. You know, it wasn't necessarily that everything they did was that way, but it kind of took on a little spirit of their own. And then these guys were working class guys, too. They would go down to Bethlehem Steel and work all day and then drive back on Eastern Ave and go to their little corner bar and they'd play there. So they were kind of working guys who had a little bit of, you know, anger and stuff they wanted to get out as well. So they play a little harder, play a little faster. And to me, that's what developed that kind of hard drive and ideal of Baltimore.
You've mentioned the banjo a few times. The banjo has a connection to Baltimore, too.
It was one of the first places it was mass-produced was actually in Baltimore. Now, it was well before bluegrass was even thought of. But it's kind of that interesting connection that, you know, maybe Baltimore was meant to be a bluegrass city because we had the banjo being built here, and then years later, we become this really key city in the development of bluegrass.
Here's a clip from Caleb Stein, a contemporary local musician who'll be performing at the festival later this month. This is I've Endured.
Well, barefoot in the summer, on into the fall. Too many mouths to feed, and they couldn't clothe us all. Got sent to church on Sunday to learn the golden rule. But I've endured, I've endured. How long must one endure?
Have younger musicians like Stein put their own signature on bluegrass?
They have, absolutely. It's interesting here in that we have this kind of great scene that is still alive today. It's been around since the 50s, and we have the Charm City Bluegrass Festival, and we have people like Caleb Stein who are kind of still playing the music. And we have these younger bands, and they've evolved. I mean, many of them didn't grow up necessarily listening to traditional music. Maybe they got into bluegrass through the Grateful Dead and Olden and the Way or stuff like that. But they love it enough, and they go, you know what? Like, we want to put our spin on it. So you do. You have bands like Mountain Ride. You have bands like the Honey Dew Drops who play different variations of it. Maybe it's not what you think of as your straight, like your grandfather's bluegrass, but it's got enough of a soul there, and it's got enough of a connection that you go, yep, that's where it comes from. And I think that's the great thing what we have going on in Baltimore is we have this long history here, and we have traditional musicians, and, you know, we've been evolving over time, and now we're getting to see the next kind of evolution of it and where it's going to go from here. And I think that's the great thing about any kind of music, but especially bluegrass, is it's constantly living and constantly evolving.
Why do you think that there seems to be an invisible line in the fans of bluegrass? It seems such a white fan base. In a city that has lots of crossover.
Well, I mean, the roots of the music still have kind of its roots in Appalachia, right? It was still working class musicians who were mostly white. I think so with some of that, it's like any other kind of music you have that comes out of certain areas, right? Hip hop or jazz, it maybe came out of some different African-American communities, and eventually you have some crossover. I just don't think there's necessarily been an artist who has necessarily crossed over. There's been African-American musicians who've played as part of it. But I don't think there's been somebody to kind of capture that dimension and maybe take it into that community. You know, it's any of those. They start in a certain community and slowly has to evolve. And I just don't think bluegrass necessarily because there was some kind of preconceived notion that it was this mountain music done by these, you know, Appalachian guys with, you know, bare feet and corncob pipes in their overalls, which isn't true at all. But there was always that kind of preconceived notion of it. So I think that is sort of why. And we just need to sort of find some musicians who are going to cross over and introduce it. I think once you hear it, you can't help yourself from dancing and listening to it and going, I want to hear more of this, you know, and you kind of get past what you think it is.
So where do you think bluegrass is heading?
I think it's great where it's heading. I mean, you see bands doing things crazy, unthought of things like adding drums to it. Oh, you know, like that's who could imagine, and, you know, electrifying it or playing rock covers in it or jamming with it or going traditional. So I think it's like any kind of music. I mean, you can sit here and label what is bluegrass, but like that's just kind of a jumping off point. And then what becomes from there, it's this acoustic kind of cool music that pulls from 1,000 different influences. You know, it's rock music is not the same that it was when, you know, Chuck Berry was playing in the 1950s. You know, it's so different now, but you need a starting point and then it just explodes from there. And I think that's what you see happening with bluegrass.
You obviously really love it. I really appreciate your sharing that with us. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me today.
Tim Newby is author of the book Bluegrass in Baltimore, The Hard-Driving Sound and Its Legacy. He's been telling us about Baltimore's deep roots in bluegrass music. Earlier, we spoke with organizers of the Charm City Bluegrass Festival, Phil Chorney and Adam Keir. The festival is Friday and Saturday, April 27th and 28th in Druid Hill Park. We have links to information about the festival and Newby's book at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you've been listening. Join us again tomorrow. If it was easy, this life ain't right for everybody, but it sure's been good to me.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.
From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Bluegrass music is often misunderstood, but those who love it claim the rhythms work their way into your bones. Organizers at the Charm City Bluegrass Festival talk about the magic that keeps thousands of fans returning each year. Then historian Tim Newby tells us about Baltimore's deep connection to the genre and where it's headed.
We have this long history here, and we have traditional musicians, and, you know, we've been evolving over time, and now we're getting to see the next kind of evolution of it and where it's going to go from here. And I think that's the great thing about any kind of music, but especially bluegrass, is it's constantly living and constantly evolving.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at WYPR.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@WYPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Bluegrass music is often described as an amalgam of Appalachian mountain music, folk music, country music, and even jazz. It turns out that Baltimore's music scene played prominently in the birth of bluegrass. Later in the show, we'll hear from an author and historian about Baltimore's bluegrass roots. With us now to talk about his dedication to deepening the connection is Phil Chorney, CEO and founder of the Charm City Bluegrass Festival and Baltimore Management Agency. The festival is coming up on April 27th and 28th. Welcome to On the Record.
Oh, thanks, Sheila.
Also with us is Adam Keir, the festival's chief marketing officer. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you so much.
Phil, what is the backstory? How did you decide to produce the Charm City Bluegrass Festival?
It started as a hangout on my front porch in Hamden. A gentleman named Jordan August, who was my co-founder, he's a really good musician. I'm not a good musician by any stretch of the imagination. I can play like two chords on mandolin and maybe like one chord on guitar. And so, but it doesn't, that's the thing about bluegrass is that lack of training or lack of skill doesn't stop you from being involved in the community of bluegrass. So Jordan would come over on a Wednesday night. We'd grab some beer from the wine market, sit on the front porch and pick. And people just started showing up, friends, strangers. They would bring instruments. They'd bring beer. They'd bring whiskey. And it turned into kind of like a bluegrass party, you know, every other week or so. And Jordan and I were both in the music industry from a management perspective, and we turned to each other and said, you know, we know the concert industry. I've been producing festivals for a couple of years, and you've been producing shows, and you're a musician. Let's throw a bluegrass party. Well, when you're looking at the logistics of throwing a wide-scale concert or party, it's not far off from a festival. So it kind of grew out of that idea, grew out of our love for live music and our love for production and our love for the music.
And so the first festival, as opposed to a picking session on your front porch, the first festival was?
6 years ago at Union Craft Brewing in their parking lot. It was they just opened up, and we had some mutual friends that worked for Union, and we said, you know, we knew they were music fans, and we came to them with the idea, and they were all on board, right? I mean, there was no hesitation. They're like, yep, what do we need to do to make it happen? And that was that first year.
Adam, when did you become interested in bluegrass?
So my mom actually owns a violin company, International Violin, and from an early age, I used to go to really local bluegrass festivals in Arcadia, Maryland, with some of her employees. So a very young age, probably early teens. And then she was sponsoring a bluegrass band, the Byron Berline Band, and I got into bluegrass through her initially, and then even more so when I met Phil in a corporate marketing job that we both had together.
The festival takes place in Druid Hill Park. How did you decide on that venue?
You know, we'd outgrown our space at Union that first year. We had sold out, I think, a month prior to the festival. And so, you know, we knew that it wasn't sustainable to keep it there, but, you know, we knew Union was a great partner. And so we kind of searched around a little bit after that first year, and we were connected to Councilman Nick Mosby at the time, who was the councilman for the 7th District, and really formed a partnership between him, Parks and Rec, City of Baltimore, and us. And so Nick was instrumental in helping us move the festival to this beautiful, beautiful space. And even before we get there, we had to find that space. So Jordan and I at the time packed into his beat-up SUV and drove around the city of Baltimore. And we said, you know, this needs to stay in the city. This is where the history of the music comes from. This is why we do it. We started this in Hamden. It needs to be in this general area. And so we were driving by, and we got out of the car at right past the zoo, right on Arcantrolley Terrace over in the park. And you look out, and there's these columns, and you look down, and it's a sweeping, almost like surreal amphitheater setting because you're so high up, and then there's a road. And we looked at each other, and we said, man, we've got a production road. We have an entrance. We have an amphitheater. We have open space, and it's right next to the conservatory. And so we walked a little bit further over, and that upper section of the conservatory used to be a set of tennis courts. And the really interesting thing about that is that's the first place there was an integrated tennis match in the United States, I believe. And there's a big plaque there. We turned to each other and said, man, this speaks to us. This needs to be the spot where we have this festival. We're bringing something that a lot of folks in the city of Baltimore didn't know was, you know, part of their culture and their heritage. And this has to celebrate that diversity and that inclusion and what music's all about. So met with Nick, and it was full steam ahead from that point, and just figuring out the logistics, working within the city's, you know, parameters, and working with Parks and Rec, and that's how it ended up, and that's where it's been ever since. They're great partners, and that makes it worthwhile.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Phil Chorney, CEO and co-founder of the Charm City Bluegrass Festival, and Adam Keir, its chief marketing officer. We're talking about the festival that happens in just a couple weeks on Friday and Saturday, April 27th and 28th in Druid Hill Park. What are some of the highlights of the festival lineup?
Obviously, The Devil Makes Three, who are a band that combines arguably a little bit of punk rock with bluegrass music, folk style, some indie. And then you have the Steel Drivers, who are a band that was headed up by Chris Stapleton, a big country music star now, and they're a great bluegrass band. On Friday, the Traveling McCurries, the sons of the great Del McCurry and the adopted sons of Del McCurry, are performing as our headliner.
This Friday is the historic lineup, right?
It hasn't gone public yet, but it will be by the time that this airs. So I'll say that we've reached out to Del's team and said, you know, Del used to play with a lot of these great musicians here in Baltimore, the guys that really, in Tim's book, he highlights. You know, wouldn't it be great to get them on stage with Del's sons, Robbie and Ronnie, and have them play some tunes that you would have seen in a bar in Baltimore in the late 60s, early 70s? And so working with our team, we reached out and got these guys all together, and they all agreed to come on Friday and pick a set old style around a solo mic. I mean, it's going to be how it was. And these are some of those up-and-coming stars, the people that made bluegrass in Baltimore what it is today, the reason why we have bluegrass, the reason why we have Charm City Bluegrass Festival in Baltimore.
There, as you know better than I, a recent documentary called Charm City Bluegrass Festival, A Renewed Baltimore Tradition, directed by Mark Shapiro. And in it, we hear a musician who says, I'm under the impression that everyone loves bluegrass, but they just don't know it yet.
There couldn't be a truer statement. I think one of the fun things is Adam and I will both bring people to the festival every year who have never heard a lick of bluegrass music, and they come and they experience bluegrass. They experience the community. They experience the people from all walks of life hearing this organic, natural, you know, type of style of music, something that's deep in soul and tradition and pain and struggle. And I think everyone can relate to that. So once they hear the banjo notes or the fiddle runs or the guitar licks, they instantly become connected with it. And because everyone around them is so connected with the same music, it's almost like groupthink in a way. And they leave saying, you know, I like that bluegrass music. I think that's for me. And it's always fun to see those people and connect with them after the festival. And I think we've both had that experience, right, Adam?
Yeah, absolutely. It's music you can dance to for the most part as well. It's a true American art form through and through, obviously with influences from, you know, folk music from all over the world. But bluegrass is through and through American, and it's a music that does yield community. And it is music that, you know, for whatever reason, when you hear it, you just start dancing, and people are really drawn to it that have never heard it before.
You also talked about diversity.
Yeah.
Which I think means primarily age diversity. Looking at the documentary, this does not seem like a racially diverse
trend.
It's not, unfortunately. And that's one of the things that we're trying to buck that trend. So we're working with the Arcontrolley Terrace Association to give a number of tickets to the citizens in that particular district. That way they can come and experience bluegrass music, which they may not have ever thought about. In years past, we partnered with like Orchids, with the BSO. I mean, it's something within the genre of music itself that it struggles with on a pretty common basis. I mean, it's a hot topic at IBMA, which is the International Bluegrass Music Association conference we've both been to. I mean, it was the keynote from Rihanna Giddens, who is an African-American opera singer, bluegrass banjoist. She's actually playing here in Baltimore in a couple of weeks, and she gave the keynote address, and that was the heart of her entire address, is finding ways to be more diversively inclusive while, you know, the music itself comes from rural areas. But what they don't know is that a lot of the gospel tunes and a lot of the traditional folk songs actually come from African-American roots, especially rural Appalachia American roots. So, you know, it's something that we struggle with, and we obviously, our festival, anyone's welcome. We want everyone and anyone to come because, like we said earlier, once you experience bluegrass music, you're hooked.
Do you host other events throughout the year?
Yeah, we do. We host a series at Westminster Hall, which is in Baltimore City as well. And we also host events at places like the 8x10 and co-sponsor with venues like Soundstage and
All Good Presents.
Sometimes, yeah, with All Good Presents, who host events at 930 Club all over D.C., all over Baltimore. So we're pretty busy year-round and looking to ramp that up.
So if we link on our website to your website, people can learn about those events
absolutely.
Also.
Yep, and through our Facebook page as well.
And getting back to this festival coming up in a few weeks on April 27th and 28th, you mentioned the first year in the brewery parking lot, you sold out a month ahead of time. Are you sold out for this venue?
Our VIP tickets are sold out.
And how many people took part last year?
Man, we a rough count's around 4,000. So this year we're expecting closer to 4,500 to 5,000 is the number where we feel comfortable, and that's where we, you know, where it'll cut off. So if we hit that number, that would be a sight to see.
Well, I appreciate your telling us about it. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Phil Chorney is CEO and founder of the Charm City Bluegrass Festival and Baltimore Management Agency. Adam Keir is the festival's chief marketing officer. The Charm City Bluegrass Festival takes place on Friday and Saturday, April 27th and 28th in Druid Hill Park. We have a link to more information at the On the Record page, wypr.org. We need to take a short break here on the record. Then we'll hear from an historian about Baltimore's bluegrass roots and Charm City's connection to the banjo. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Drinking dark whiskey.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about bluegrass music and its connection to Baltimore. We spoke earlier with organizers of the Charm City Bluegrass Festival that's happening April 27th and 28th in Druid Hill Park. With us now is Tim Newby, author of the book Bluegrass in Baltimore, The Hard-Driving Sound and Its Legacy. Newby teaches technology education at Chesapeake High School in Anne Arundel County, and he was featured in the documentary Charm City Bluegrass Festival, A Renewed Baltimore Tradition, directed by Mark Shapiro. Welcome to On the Record, Tim.
Thank you. Excited to be here and talk about some bluegrass and talk about Baltimore.
Well, first, is there typical instrumentation for a bluegrass band?
Well, generally when you think of it, you're thinking of acoustic instruments, and kind of the traditional lineup would be a mandolin, a fiddle, an upright bass, and a guitar. And then obviously a banjo. You need a banjo in there as well. And you can kind of have different variations of that, but that's kind of what you think of, you know, the traditional lineup and the lineup that Bill Monroe started when he kind of sort of evolved this sound back in the 40s.
Let's listen to a clip of Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys. On this one, they're performing A Voice from On High. What is the story of Monroe and the birth of bluegrass?
Bluegrass, despite some of the kind of perceptions, is actually a fairly new word in the grand scheme of things. It wasn't really commonly used until the late 50s, early 60s. It comes from Bill Monroe, and he had a band, Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys, and it was named because he was from Kentucky. But originally, he was playing mostly kind of a country style. It was a little faster. It was played with this kind of instrumentation. But they were taking different variations of gospel songs and stuff like that. Eventually, they kind of started evolving it into what we think of as a traditional bluegrass sound, but it wasn't called that. It takes on the bluegrass sound because there was an acrimonious split between Bill Monroe and a couple guys in his bands, Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs. And when Flatt and Scruggs would go and play, people would want to hear the songs that they did with Bill Monroe, and they were kind of scared to say Bill Monroe's name around those two. And they would say, could you play some of those bluegrass tunes? And it sort of developed from there. And then in the 60s, Bill Monroe gave an interview, and he kind of said, I don't play country. I play bluegrass. And that was kind of when it was, now we have something different. But it took a long time for it to kind of develop into what we think of as bluegrass. And over the years, you know, it kind of became rooted in this idea that it was from Appalachia, but that's not necessarily entirely true. It has its roots there. Lots of the fiddle sounds comes from like old Irish jig kind of music. But it doesn't necessarily have its roots there. It really starts developing when people start leaving the mountains a little bit and start playing it. And I always say, like, lots of the songs, you know, sing about things like the old home place. Well, you can't miss the old home place till you leave it. So a lot of these people moved out of the mountains and moved into cities like Baltimore and Cincinnati and Columbus and Dayton. And they started playing this music, and it sort of evolved from there in the 50s into what we think of as bluegrass. And Bill Monroe was always kind of present throughout playing this and kind of leading the way a little bit.
How did the music's development get so connected to Baltimore?
Well, Baltimore at the time was, you know, one of the 10 largest cities in the U.S. in the 50s, which I think is something interesting to always think about. We don't think of Baltimore as being that big a city, but it was. And it was a huge hub of industry. We had Bethlehem Steel. We had the Martin Bomber factory. So you had a lot of these kind of Appalachian migrants moving out from West Virginia and Southern Virginia and Kentucky and places like that looking for work. And Baltimore was a prime destination. I mean, again, along with places like Columbus and Dayton. But they kind of came here, and what do people do? They bring things they know. So they brought some music, and how do people connect? Well, they get together, and they play music, and they pick, and they kind of do that. So they would get together and kind of pick and play, and eventually they were like, we can maybe take it out a little bit. We'll play in some of these local bars for kind of our friends or play out and stuff like that. I mean, as anybody does who gets in a band. So it sort of started slowly from there with people bringing the music. Baltimore was a little different than other cities, as we also had like Johns Hopkins and Towson College at the time. So you had this kind of folky side as well. And they kind of came together here more so than other cities. In other cities, they might be really separate, these folkies and these kind of true blue kind of hillbillies from the mountains. But they kind of came together here and played together. And we also had Mike Seeger here. Mike is Pete Seeger's half-brother, and he was living in Baltimore in the 50s. He was a conscientious objector to the Korean War and was doing his alternative service at a hospital around here. And he was a big music collector, obviously coming from the Seeger family. And he met Arnold Dickens, who is brother to Hazel Dickens, who becomes a legendary kind of figure in bluegrass. And he kind of got involved in that scene. And one of the reasons Baltimore, more so than other cities, kind of evolved is he was here and he was recording music. And this is in the 50s, so people weren't whipping out their iPhones and recording it there. He had to lug around a gigantic recorder, and he had access to that. And he was making some albums here, and he used his buddies from Baltimore who he met at a house party. So these names kind of got out a little bit. And, you know, he was able to help kind of foster that connection. And he helps foster a connection with Alan Lomax, who's going to invite some Baltimore bands up to New York to, you know, take part in a concert up at Carnegie Hall. So it really was all of those elements coming together that made Baltimore kind of explode as far as a bluegrass scene.
That's Tim Newby, author of the book Bluegrass in Baltimore, The Hard Driving Sound and Its Legacy. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about Baltimore's deep roots of bluegrass music. Here's a clip from a Baltimore-based band from the 50s, Earl Taylor and the Stony Mountain Boys, performing White House Blues.
McKinney, hollering, McKinney, squall, Doc said, McKinney, I can't find the gold, you're bound to die, bound to die.
Is that the hard-driving sound your book title suggests?
It is, and I love that song. Earl Taylor was a key figure in Baltimore, and they kind of played that sped-up version. White House Blues is an old song that's been around since the 20s. It's actually about the assassination of President McKinley. So it's been around for a long time. A guy, Charlie Poole, used to do it, and it was not played like this. But Earl Taylor, along with his band, which included a banjo player named Walt Hensley, kind of took it and revved it up. And when I was kind of doing my research for my book, the term hard driving kept coming up. And what everybody told me is, you know, they played the music a little louder, a little faster here. And the reason why is they were mostly playing it in bars, and they were playing unamplified music in a bar. So, you know, if you're playing an acoustic instrument, think about the music, the sounds that are in a bar. You got people talking, people drinking. They're more interested in doing their thing. So they were playing louder, faster to draw that attention in to kind of overcome the rumble of what was being said in the bar and stuff like that. So it developed a little louder, faster. You know, it wasn't necessarily that everything they did was that way, but it kind of took on a little spirit of their own. And then these guys were working class guys, too. They would go down to Bethlehem Steel and work all day and then drive back on Eastern Ave and go to their little corner bar and they'd play there. So they were kind of working guys who had a little bit of, you know, anger and stuff they wanted to get out as well. So they play a little harder, play a little faster. And to me, that's what developed that kind of hard drive and ideal of Baltimore.
You've mentioned the banjo a few times. The banjo has a connection to Baltimore, too.
It was one of the first places it was mass-produced was actually in Baltimore. That was well before bluegrass was even thought of. But it's kind of that interesting connection that, you know, maybe Baltimore was meant to be a bluegrass city because we had the banjo being built here, and then years later we become this really key city in the development of bluegrass.
Here's a clip from Caleb Stein, a contemporary local musician who'll be performing at the festival later this month. This is I've Endured.
Well, barefoot in the summer, on into the fall. Too many mouths to feed, and they couldn't clothe us all. Got sent to church on Sunday to learn the golden rule. But I've endured, I've endured. How long must one endure?
Have younger musicians like Stein put their own signature on bluegrass?
They have, absolutely. It's interesting here in that we have this kind of great scene that is still alive today. It's been around since the 50s, and we have the Charm City Bluegrass Festival, and we have people like Caleb Stein who are kind of still playing the music. And we have these younger bands, and they've evolved. I mean, many of them didn't grow up necessarily listening to traditional music. Maybe they got into bluegrass through the Grateful Dead and Olden and the Way or stuff like that. But they love it enough, and they go, you know what? Like, we want to put our spin on it. So you do. You have bands like Mountain Ride. You have bands like the Honey Dew Drops who play different variations of it. Maybe it's not what you think of as your straight, like your grandfather's bluegrass, but it's got enough of a soul there, and it's got enough of a connection that you go, yep, that's where it comes from. And I think that's the great thing what we have going on in Baltimore is we have this long history here, and we have traditional musicians, and, you know, we've been evolving over time, and now we're getting to see the next kind of evolution of it and where it's going to go from here. And I think that's the great thing about any kind of music, but especially bluegrass, is it's constantly living and constantly evolving.
Why do you think that there seems to be an invisible line in the fans of bluegrass? It seems such a white fan base in a city that has lots of crossover.
Well, I mean, the roots of the music still have kind of its roots in Appalachia, right? It was still working class musicians who are mostly white. I think so with some of that, it's like any other kind of music you have that comes out of certain areas, right? Hip hop or jazz, it maybe came out of some different African-American communities, and eventually you have some crossover. I just don't think there's necessarily been an artist who has necessarily crossed over. There's been African-American musicians who've played as part of it, but I don't think there's been somebody to kind of capture that dimension and maybe take it into that community. You know, it's any of those, they start in a certain community and slowly has to evolve. And I just don't think bluegrass necessarily, because there was some kind of preconceived notion that it was this mountain music done by these, you know, Appalachian guys with, you know, bare feet and corncob pipes in their overalls, which isn't true at all. But there was always that kind of preconceived notion of it. So I think that is sort of why. And we just need to sort of find some musicians who are going to cross over and introduce it. I think once you hear it, you can't help yourself from dancing and listening to it and going, I want to hear more of this, you know, and you kind of get past what you think it is.
So where do you think bluegrass is heading?
I think it's great where it's heading. I mean, you see bands doing things crazy, unthought of things like adding drums to it. Oh, you know, like that's who could imagine, and, you know, electrifying it or playing rock covers in it or jamming with it or going traditional. So I think it's like any kind of music. I mean, you can sit here and label what is bluegrass, but like that's just kind of a jumping off point. And then what becomes from there, it's this acoustic kind of cool music that pulls from 1,000 different influences. You know, it's rock music is not the same that it was when, you know, Chuck Berry was playing in the 1950s. You know, it's so different now, but you need a starting point and then it just explodes from there. And I think that's what you see happening with bluegrass.
You obviously really love it. I really appreciate your sharing that with us. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me today.
Tim Newby is author of the book Bluegrass in Baltimore, The Hard Driving Sound and Its Legacy. He's been telling us about Baltimore's deep roots in bluegrass music. Earlier, we spoke with organizers of the Charm City Bluegrass Festival, Phil Chorney and Adam Keir. The festival is Friday and Saturday, April 27th and 28th in Druid Hill Park. We have links to information about the festival and Newby's book at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you've been listening. Join us again tomorrow. If it was easy, this life ain't right for everybody, but it sure's been good to me.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.